How are you doing today? It's 2019, and I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food, and I'm ready for a whole new year. Are you? There's plenty of things to talk about when it comes to food, as always. And in just a few months, we'll be celebrating our 10th year anniversary on this program. So we're going to have a big party somewhere in March. Everybody's invited right here, online, in cyberspace, celebrating It's All About Food. I wanted to tell you a couple of things before I bring on my two guests and get started with the main event for today. Number one, I just heard that the Progressive Radio Network now has a voicemail line. Do you know that number? 862-800-6805. 862-800-6805. And here is an opportunity for those of you who are listening in the future. Hello out there in the future. And want to make a comment or have a question. Of course, you can always send me an email at info@realmeals.org, but maybe you want your voice to be heard, and you can do it through the Progressive Radio Network at this phone number. And then when you give your name, the show, It's All About Food, and your question, I'll be able to respond to it at the next show. So I hope you take advantage of this. This is really a new, fun option. The next thing I wanted to mention, you may remember my friend Michael Boss. He's been on this program. I featured him a while back with an audio program, and then there was a partner video program on my nonprofit website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. And he is the owner of the Sonoma Horticulture Nursery. It's a historic nursery in Sebastopol, California. It's a rare gem. It's 7.5 acres. It's stunning. It has rhododendrons all throughout the woods. It's just an amazing place. Azaleas, all kinds of things. And I'm mentioning it because he's looking for a partner. He's looking for people who are passionate about plants that can help turn the Sonoma Horticulture Nursery into a thriving enterprise. And of course, there's edible plants there, long-lived edible plants for sustainable gardens. And if this sounds exciting or interesting to you, and maybe you have some financial means to invest, you can send me an email at info@realmeals.org, and I will send you to the right place. It's really a paradise. It's amazing, and we want to keep it going. All right, then, let's talk about being humane. I am going to bring on my two guests, Hope Bohannick and Justin Van Cleek. A little bit about both of them. Hope has been active in animal protection and environmental activism for over 25 years and published the book, The Ultimate Betrayal, Is There Happy Meat? We talked about that book on this program. She is nationally recognized as a leader and speaker in the animal protection movement and serves as projects manager for United Poultry Concerns. Hope is also the executive director of Compassionate Living, a Sonoma County, California-based vegan advocacy organization. And before this, Hope offered her organizational talents as the campaigns director at In Defense of Animals. She's the primary organizer at the United Poultry Concerns annual Conscious Eating Conference at UC Berkeley, as well as the Sonoma County Veg Fest and the Berkeley Earth Day. I was at the Berkeley Earth Day once. And Justin Van Cleek has a PhD in English and is a freelance writer, educator, and community organizer. Justin spends most of his time working at the Triangle Chicken Advocates Micro Sanctuary, which he and his wife founded in 2014 and which inspired them to start the Micro Sanctuary movement later that year. He also founded and contributes to the radical vegan blog, Striving with Systems. Justin is also serving on currently serves as the sanctuary and micro sanctuary advisor for A Well-Fed World, another great organization that we love. Hope and Justin, hello, happy new year, and thanks for joining me today. Hope, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having us on, Karen.
I'm excited to hear what both of you are working on. And Justin, are you with us?
Yes, hi, thank you.
Okay. So I just looked up the definition of humane for fun. And it's the definition I found really quick was having or showing compassion or benevolence. And then there are a lot of adjectives. Unfortunately, sometimes I think humane means like coming from humans, and we're not always very compassionate or benevolent. But we're going to talk about the Humane Hoax, an online summit. We're going to get to that in a little bit. But can we talk about raising animals in a way that people have labeled humane for food?
Yeah. What is this new humane labeling that we're seeing? And that's, you know, what Justin and I are going to be tackling this weekend with our online summit, our webinar, the Humane Hoax Online Summit. And, we as animal advocates and activists have been doing a really excellent job with very little resources, very few of us, very little money in the last several decades. And I know, Karen, you've been doing this work alongside me and Justin for a very long time. Yep. And that's right. And we've done a really excellent job of exposing the truth behind animal farming, the cruelty, the environmental degradation, the health effects and problems. So, people are becoming more aware, which is great. They're becoming concerned for the welfare of these animals. And the sales are going down. And the market's getting concerned. The industry is worried. And so they have reacted and responded by changing the labels, changing the story, changing the conception and the narrative. And basically now they're presenting that there's a better way to do it, that there's a more humane way. There's small scale farming. There's organic. There's free range. All of these labels that we're seeing. So I did some extensive research on this issue and wrote my book that you mentioned, The Ultimate Betrayal. And what I found and what numerous other advocates and writers and thinkers that are looking into this have found is that, unfortunately, the difference in conventional farming, your basic farming, and these new labels is very minimal. There's very little difference going on. The difference is in the story and the marketers, trying to change perceptions, not really in what's really going on the farm. And it's not only the labeling. There's a whole mindset around, like homesteading and DIY, the do-it-yourself kind of thing, and raising chickens in your backyard for eggs, or slaughtering your own animals. Like rabbits are becoming much more a kind of popular animal to slaughter for meat. So there's this whole mindset around, well, we don't have to give up animal products. We can do this. We can do this better, right? But unfortunately, the reality is that, breeding and raising and slaughtering animals can really never be humane. You cannot commodify someone's body and expect there to be a humane way to do it. And it's interesting that you said the definition of humane. The word actually did come from human, from being human, because we have the capacity to make the choice to be compassionate and to make compassionate decisions. So the word humane actually came from being human. How ironic is that? And look what we're doing to the animals on this planet.
Whoa. Yes. And I can tell I could hear you breathing. I could hear all of the time and research and frustration and all of your emotion in that very articulate presentation. I thank you for that. I feel your pain. So I know that I've read many articles recently talking about question of whether we should eat animals or not, and this movement towards eating more plants. And there always seems to be a discussion that everybody wants to treat animals nicely. There's this idea that people want to be fair and just and kind. And then there's this gap or this divide somehow, maybe, and I'm sure the labels contribute to it, but there's just something where people still want to eat animals.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And I mean, from my experience, having run a farmed animal rescue and sanctuary for 5 years now, I see kind of all dimensions of that phenomenon, you know. And for me, I mean, what I've encountered firsthand is the extent to which people like to feel like the animals that that we raise for food are living a nice life. But at the end of the day, what that actually boils down to is the aesthetics of raising animals. It has nothing to do with the ethics of eating animals. And if you actually get to know the history of what these animals have gone through over millennia of being domesticated for the sole purpose of becoming food for humans, you realize that, you know, every moment of their lives is about their final goal of being consumed by one human or another. And that affects every moment of their lives from the moment they're born to the moment that they die. And so, you know, I actually understand and I can empathize with folks who have seen what happens in large scale industrial farms and are repulsed by it because it is repulsive. But farmers and marketers have also realized that it's repulsive. And so that's why the humane hoax is such a tricky problem, is because that people are taking that moment of compassion and that moment of awareness, and they're directing people back right into the system of raising and exploiting and killing animals, rather than the other option, which is to stop. And you know, along with running a sanctuary for rescued farmed animals, I've been vegan for almost 20 years now, and like, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me that that second option isn't for some reason on the table, but for some reason it isn't. So the humane hoax is extremely problematic because it provides people with the sense of getting out of that very you know, viscerally offensive system of large-scale industrial farming, and giving them what seems like a much more wholesome option of supporting small-scale so-called humane farmers who are raising these animals. And we can go into lots more detail of why, like, that notion of, like, a happy animal on a loving farm being slaughtered by the farmer who raises them is really, really the ultimate betrayal, like Hope has said in the title of her book. But at the end of the day, what it boils down to is the ethics of exploitation and the ethics of domination. And that doesn't go away regardless of the conditions that animal grows up in, you know, spends their time in, or dies in. Because ethically, the fact that we still dominate and then, you know, ultimately take the lives of these beings who can't consent is ethically unsustainable. It's ethically indefensible. And, you know, ultimately, the only way to respond to the horrors of, you know, animal farming are to stop supporting the people who raise and kill animals for food for us.
So let's touch on some of the issues that are hoaxes. And one that comes to mind for me is people who say they're buying grass-fed, they're buying free-range, and they feel better about it. And then whether grass-fed is humane or not, let's just put that aside. Number one, we can't possibly grow the amount of animals to feed people in the quantities that they eat today if all animals were allowed to be grazing freely. There's just, we need several Earths to do that. But put that aside. I sit sometimes and dine with people who say that they eat ethically, eating free range and grass fed, and then I see what they order, and there's nothing on the menu that says that the particular flesh that they're eating is from any special place. And then I think, do they just say it because they feel better saying it, but they don't really do it? So there's just so many different layers here.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So it is interesting that there was a poll recently done of people that consume animal products, and 75% of people that are eating animal products think that they're coming from humane sources, that the animal products they get are coming from humane and sustainable sources. And that's just impossible for the amount of people that are eating animals to be able to be eating those labels. It's true because these labels exist, because there's humane labels out there, because of the marketing, people have this, they're lulled into the sense that there's improvement overall, that something, you know, everything's kind of improving and getting better on the animal farms. And that is not the case. If anything, it is getting worse in most instances. So, you know, that it's really a false sense of security that people are kind of lulled into with these labels. And you're right. You know, even if they say that they're buying humane labeling, products with humane labels, if you pull further, you know, it's a very small percentage of the animal products they're actually eating. It's really a concern for sure. And as far as grass-fed, you know, you mentioned grass-fed, it's so interesting because when I did the research for my book, I assumed that I'd be saying, oh, well, you know, this label and that label's better, but going vegan's best. That's actually not the case in a lot of instances, and grass-fed is actually one of those instances. Grass-fed beef actually contributes 50 to 60% more greenhouse gases than conventionally grown beef, and uses tons more land for the same amount of animals as well as more water. So this is no solution for the environment at all. Like you said, you know, if we suddenly tried to free range and graze all of the animals that are confined in you know, confinement barns and buildings right now, there would not be enough Earth. We'd need closer to five planet Earths. You're absolutely right. So, you know, we can't scale up, you know, free ranging. It just can't be done to feed 7 billion people. You know, this kind of marketing and small-scale labeling, it's really just for a few elite buyers that want to, that are able to pay higher prices. This can't be scaled up.
Yeah, definitely. And I would just add on to that briefly that there's a very direct connection between the supposed, like, you know, humane, grass-fed methods of raising animals for food and the industrial farms that everybody acts like they don't love. And because just as you mentioned that when you sit down with someone who's eating animal products at a table, they have no idea, the menu doesn't indicate where those animals came from, because if animals remain on the table, they always remain on the table. So, you know, yes, you may go to the farmer's market every weekend to buy your happy veal and your happy eggs and your happy cheese, but if you go out to dinner with someone, you're also eating stuff off the menu that may or may not have come from, you know, an animal coming out of a CAFO. So as long as animal products remain on the table, there's this constant pressure to scale up that supply. And so that's why industrial animal farming becomes a logical conclusion, is because we can't feed the people who want this food in ways that are even feasible without introducing the industrial food complex, and that's where, you know, large-scale animal farming comes in. So, you know, the points that Hope made are really salient because, you know, it's not like you can pick one way of eating an animal product that's wonderful and not also bring in all these other problems that come with it, in addition to those the hidden problems that aren't actually wonderful in the thing that you're eating.
Okay, now let's move to the organic standards, because I think that's another label, and the organic standards are very important. I buy mostly organic food at home and even try to get to restaurants that advertise that they use primarily organic foods. It's very important, but I think the label is confusing to some people, because people think organic means kind and humane and compassionate.
Right.
Does it?
Justin, do you want to get started? You want me to start on this one?
Yes, sure. Yes, unfortunately, organic, that label is actually probably the only label that's actually regulated out of all of the ones that people typically encounter with products they're buying in the store. So when it comes to animal products like grass-fed and humane and cage-free and pasture-raised and all those sorts of things, you know, those aren't regulated in the way that organic is. And so what organic is it strictly means that chemicals like pesticides and antibiotics and hormones aren't entering into the food supply, at least not a major portion. So, and people may see that and they may think that's wonderful, but unfortunately, that has no bearing on the well-being and the conditions in which those animals are living. And one example that I've experienced firsthand, and that is really kind of startling, is that on organic dairy farms, you know, those cows, by you know, stricture of the label that these farmers are getting of being organic, they do not provide chemicals to the cows. So they don't provide hormones, they don't provide, you know, antibiotics and all these sorts of things. And people think that's wonderful because that means that they're not going to be getting the residues of these chemicals in the milk that they're drinking. But unfortunately, because cows are constantly impregnated, constantly giving birth, and constantly lactating, they very frequently get an infection of the udder called mastitis. And that's a very easily treatable infection with antibiotics. But as you probably have figured out from what I just said, on an organic farm, these cows are not allowed to have antibiotics. And so if a cow, through no fault of her own, just simply from the faults of from the you know, consequences of being, you know, constantly impregnated and constantly lactated, she gets an infection and she's culled, she's killed, she's sent to slaughter because she has a very easily treatable infection of her udders, but she cannot receive antibiotics on this farm because the farm is organic. So, I mean, that's one instance, but it's a very telling instance in which the organic farms and the organic labels have no bearing whatsoever on the living conditions and the welfare of the animals who are raised on those farms and get those labels when they're sent to the grocery store.
Yeah, I'll add that. Yeah, it's absolutely right what Justin's saying. It's a prime example of where these labels just don't provide what people think they do. They don't reflect what people are thinking. You know, and this is another one of those instances, like grass-fed beef, where it can be even worse for the animals, for the environment. So I did extensive research in my book on this, and I had a veterinarian confide in me that he saw cows with the most advanced stages of mastitis, this infection of the udder, with open sores, pus, where it was very painful for them to be milked. That he saw the most advanced cases on organic dairy farms, like he had never seen in the 30 years past on conventional farming. Because they won't give the animals the antibiotics and medications to clear up these infections. They'd have to take her out this particular cow out of production and couldn't sell her milk. So they don't. And as Justin said, they just send them to slaughter. And this, it just shows you how it's a business. They're not putting an organic label on milk for concern for the animal. That's not where they're doing it. They're doing it because the customers are demanding something better, and unfortunately, it is no better for the animals.
There are discussions about improving the organic standards regulations, and those discussions include more ethical treatment of animals, and it includes some better treatment of the environment as well. And we'll see if they do improve. But right now, there's blood on those organic standard hands.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Let's talk a little bit about those folks who know all of this information and really are trying their best to eat sustainably, organic, eat a lot of plants, but they like to have backyard chickens for eggs. Is that okay?
Sorry, I was chuckling.
I know some people who really love their chickens.
and so do I. And that's, it's funny because in 5 years of doing chicken rescue that primarily involves backyard chickens and having rescued hundreds of chickens from these situations, I understand why people think that that's like the pinnacle of the way that we can treat animals is by having a flock of backyard chickens who give us eggs because, you know, eggs just naturally pop out and the chickens are happy running around the backyard and all this sorts of stuff. And I can tell you from experience that that's not the case. And there are a number of reasons why that's not the case, and I'll try to be very brief because I realize we're on a time schedule here and I can talk for hours about it.
You can talk as long as you want.
Okay. So the first issue is that the very first issue is that let's pause for a moment, not think about the eggs, but think about the roosters. Mm. So chickens hatch, like most species, roughly half, like, you know, half and half, boys and girls. But 99% of the cities and towns that allow people to keep backyard chickens make it illegal for you to keep a rooster. Even if you wanted to keep, you know, dozens of roosters, you could not legally keep one because the moment that a neighbor hears a crow, they're going to call animal control. Animal control is going to be on your door, and they're going to either seize your rooster or tell you that you have, you know, 3, 4, or 5 days to get rid of that rooster or you're going to be fined. So What my life basically consists of is catching roosters who have been dumped in the woods or finding homes for roosters who have been dumped at shelters because of backyard chicken keeping. Because when somebody buys chicks at a feed store or orders chicks from a hatchery or, you know, has chicks hatch at their own little backyard farm, roughly half of them are going to be males. And, you know, most people just don't want to deal with roosters because they think that they're mean, because they crow, you know, or because they legally can't keep them. And so, you know, the hidden victims of the backyard egg industry are the boys. And so, you know, most chicken rescuers like us spend the majority of their time trying to figure out how to help the boys who have made it out of the hatcheries. They're typically killed, you know, at hatcheries when they're about a day old or so. But if they somehow make it out of that, because sexing is inaccurate, is the moment that they crow, out they go. And they're either sent to the shelter or they're sent to the woods or they're just killed outright. And so, you know, it's fine if somebody has a happy flock of hens running around their backyard, but if they have 6 hens, if they don't have 6 roosters, then they've automatically guaranteed that they are killing roosters, baby boys, who have done nothing wrong other than to be born male. And that's true on the largest scale farm or the smallest scale backyard chicken flock. And then along with that, because there's so little regulation for people who keep backyard chickens, I've seen every manner of, you know, neglect, predator attacks, all these sorts of things in which people are, you know, keep chickens in their backyard and they don't give them what they need to be kept safe. And the moment that they get, you know, sick or they get attacked by something, by some other animal, by a predator, they don't want to spend money on them because they just, you know, they paid $5 for them at the feed store. So why would you spend several hundred dollars at the vet? You know, and so like that's another very, very common issue that we deal with. And then along with that, the breeding that has been done to hens to make them lay several hundred eggs per year brings with it a whole host of biological abnormalities, primarily centered in the reproductive system, that will make their bodies self-destruct. And the average lifespan of a laying hen is maybe one quarter to one half of the lifespan of their wild ancestor, a red jungle fowl, because of the fact that they've been bred to lay hundreds and hundreds of eggs rather than, you know, a dozen a year.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just add a couple things on that, tacking on. You know, as an animal advocate, being an animal rights activist, throughout the years, I often get approached with an animal issue, you know, some animal that has been abandoned or is in trouble, and it happens maybe once every few months or something, and I will attempt to, you know, help the situation in whatever way I can. Things have really shifted in the last 5 years, and now I get a request to help home a rooster probably weekly now. I mean, it's awful. There are so many roosters that are out there abandoned, you know, nobody knows what to do with them. He's at the Humane Society. They're going to euthanize him, you know, and this is because of the backyard chicken, you know, keeping chickens in your backyard for eggs. It really has increased the amount of animals that are abandoned and abused and in need, and that's the roosters. And I'll back up a little further, too, to the hatcheries. So most people get their chickens for backyard eggs at, like, a feed store, sometimes on Craigslist. You know, they're just looking for chicks to buy. And most all these chicks are coming from hatcheries, industrial hatcheries. And these places, I mean, you know, what would be a natural way for a chicken to be born? Of course, in a warm nest with a loving hen over the eggs, and, you know, being a doting mother hen and a beautiful, warm, natural situation. No, completely, completely denied in these hatcheries. The little chicks are born in, you know, metal drawers. They're almost immediately thrust onto conveyor belts and machinery, and workers handling them like canned goods. And, you know, it's brutal. And then, as Justin said, if they're egg-laying hens and not the chickens raised, bred for meat, the egg layers, half are boys, half are male. And they're almost immediately killed by the millions. They're going out to the dumpsters. They just take them out live and throw them in the dumpsters to suffocate on the way to their brothers, dying of dehydration and exposure. Some are taken down conveyor belts and dropped into maceration machines, which are huge, like, metal blenders to just grind them up alive. It's absolutely one of the most tragic and horrible things in animal agriculture, and it absolutely connects to eggs. So you never, ever should buy a chick or a chicken from anywhere unless it's a sanctuary or a rescue situation. You know, it's the only way you ever want to get a chicken, because you don't want to give money to these industries and perpetuate the killing of all these males.
Yeah, and if I can just add one more thing. As we're talking, I'm looking out the window, and I'm watching 30 roosters run around together as a flock in a yard. All of these roosters have been dumped at a shelter, dumped in the woods, and been caught, you know, by us saving them from a terrible death by predators terrified in the night. And these roosters are all living together, getting along together, living a wonderful life together. And, you know,
yeah, it's a myth that they don't get along or can't get along.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the backyard farmers perpetuate the lies of the industry about who roosters are, about who these animals are. And I live with them. Like I see who they are as individuals. And so, you know, what the backyard chicken keepers will tell you is that, you know, their roosters are aggressive and attack them and they're mean and they fight constantly. And I'm watching 30 roosters dust bathe together and take sun baths together and, you know, call each other over for treats and food. And, you know, the reality of the situation, if you're vegan and you know who these animals are, is so offensive and appalling when you see the way that these farmers talk about them. And that happens at every scale. And so the worth that these animals have and the respect that these animals deserve has nothing to do with what they provide for us for food. And unfortunately, when they become food, they become devalued and they become next to worthless. And, you know, like I spend almost every moment of my day watching the reality of these individuals and seeing how much they are truly worth while listening to backyard farmers tell us how they can't keep a rooster. They don't want a rooster now. So, you know, the points that Hope made are really just really powerful. And my experience, you know, rescuing roosters and watching them coexist together, it really belies the myth that even the smallest scale backyard farmer will spin to you about why they can't have a rooster.
I'm thinking recently I was in a suburban neighborhood and I saw a rooster walking around outside of the individual home's grounds, kind of like around the sidewalk, and I never thought what the story might be behind that rooster. And maybe he was just let go. It's not something that's intuitive, and it's such an important point that I'm going to repeat it, and that is the fact that it's pretty much 50-50 male and female when chicks are born and when you just choose to purchase the female chicks, that you should realize that that number of boy chicks are being destroyed.
Yeah, and this really speaks, I think, to that the basis of all this, the underlying current that we must address is that we have to stop looking at meat, dairy, and eggs as food. It's not food. It is the commodification of another sentient animal's body and body parts. You know, we really have to stop looking at eggs as food. As long as we're thinking that there can be this or that, you know, humane, quote-unquote humane situation, there will be exploitation and abuse in another situation. We have to stop thinking of eggs as food. We can't expect there to be 100% humane situations and feed 7 billion people eggs. It can never be done.
Okay, let's talk about the Humane Hoax webinar that you two are putting together.
Great. Yes, it's coming up this weekend, the Humane Hoax online summit, the Humane Hoax online summit. And we're very excited about it. Justin and I were on a panel called the Humane Hoax at the National Animal Rights Conference this summer in LA. And it was such a popular panel. We had the room just standing room only. It was packed full. And we thought how amazing it would be to do a conference just specifically on this issue because there seemed to be so much interest. So we're going to do it this weekend. It's free this Saturday and Sunday. We have speakers, different speakers both days, an amazing lineup of speakers talking about all different aspects of this issue. It's really easy to sign up. If you go to find our Facebook page, Humane Hoax Facebook page, the very first post takes you straight to the registration.
And how long is it each day? What time does it start? How long does it run? Will it be aired again if people miss it?
Yeah, so the start time is both days is going to be 1 p.m. Eastern time. So depending on where you're at in the country, you know, we're using the Eastern time starting point just as a reference. So, you know, if you're on the Pacific coast, it would be 10 o'clock, you know, so just adjust according to where you're at. But we'll be going from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. both days. That's Eastern time. And each day we'll have four different speakers. And I'm personally excited because all of the speakers that we have are just personal heroes of mine, and they're doing amazing work, you know, on many aspects, not only of the problems of animal agriculture as a whole, but specifically on the issue of the humane hoax. And so, yes, this coming Saturday, January 12th, and Sunday, January 13th, we'll be starting at 1 p.m. Eastern time and ending roughly around 5 p.m. Eastern time. And if you just go to the Humane Hoax Facebook page, our registration link is the first post on that page.
So this is the power of the internet, because while it's wonderful to be able to go to a conference and hear speakers and meet them in person, it's fun and it's engaging and you get inspired and energized. Not everybody can do that. It can be expensive. It could be it could be, I'm at a loss for words here. It's geographically prohibitive.
Geographically limited,
You're doing it online, and that's great, and bringing, I don't know who the speakers are. Maybe you could tell us who are going to be presenting, but I'm sure they're wonderful. And this is a great opportunity for people who really want to get infused with all of this knowledge. And if perhaps you're someone who believes in humane agriculture and feel you can defend it, you might want to watch and see if you still feel the way you do when it's over. I'm wondering, will there be anything actionable after people watch, or is this for information only?
That's a great question, and I'm actually really excited that our final speaker of the event on Sunday afternoon will be Robert Grillo from Free From Harm, and he's actually going to be talking about that very issue of taking action, you know, against the humane hoax. And I think that's kind of the new frontier, really, in terms of vegan and animal rights advocacy, is looking for ways to confront the humane hoax, not only at a large scale, like, you know, the labels on the egg cartons in Whole Foods, but also on the local scale, like what are the ordinances in your local town on backyard chicken keeping and backyard livestock keeping and backyard slaughter. You know, we often forget the fact that we're citizens in, you know, wherever place we live, and that we can have a direct impact that way. And oftentimes the ordinances in the very cities we live in are really, really problematic when it comes to the way that they allow people to do direct violence to animals. So Robert on Sunday afternoon is going to be speaking about the issue of taking action, but all of the speakers are going to be speaking in a way that I think will inform the choices that people make in their individual lives, and how they are able to understand and speak about the phenomenon of you know, humane animal farming. And to me, as a vegan, you know, who's been an ethical vegan for two decades now, like, I really see the need and the importance of all of us coming to understand how to, you know, to think about and talk about these other forms of agriculture besides, you know, the whole factory farming label, because we've been doing that for so long now, and then the moment that the conversation shifts to, oh, but I might buy my, you know, buy my eggs from my neighbor, like, we just, you know, so it's so often hard to have an intelligent conversation about why that's also wrong. So that's really, for me, like, I think where we need to go to expand the reach of the advocacy that we do as vegans, really is to be able to incorporate that aspect of animal agriculture into our advocacy.
Wonderful. Well, I hope this expands the movement. I hope people take advantage of this opportunity and learn a lot and then want to do more about it. It's so important. I'm just wondering, there was an article in the news yesterday that, it was the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday that made a decision that I just wanted to mention, where they rejected the latest challenge to California's ban on foie gras.
That's right.
Yeah. What's amazing is California started this process by enacting the law in 2004. It didn't go into effect until 2012. And here we are still talking about whether we should do it or not in 2019. And I just want to mention, I lived in France for 4 years and I had friends who love foie gras. And they would tell me that the ducks and geese really were happy and that they would run to get the tube down their throat and be fed.
Yeah, because that's what the marketers were telling them.
We have chickens who run us to run up to us when we bring out, you know, a treat for them as well. The difference is I don't stuff those treats down their throat. That's just animal behavior. When they know that you're the source of a wonderful, you know, something yummy, they're going to run to you, and that's what these people exploit. Is natural behavior like that by domesticated animals. You know, if you walk up to a duck with a tube in the wild, they're going to fly away from you because they don't want to mess with you. But if you do that with a duck who has been domesticated and you've been, you know, feeding like that, they're still going to want that yummy treat. I mean, I see that with my chickens every day.
It's not the case in foie gras. There were undercover investigations, video footage, photographs, where the birds were cowering in the corner and the workers were having to grab them and stuff the tube down their throats. Yeah. If they had it done before, they knew that it hurt. They knew that it was not a pleasant experience and they did not run to the tubes. That's not the case at all.
Yeah.
There's video and photographic documentation of that. The birds would cower from the tube. You know, that's just a marketing lie. I've actually been working on this issue for a long time. Back when I was with In Defense of Animals 10 years ago, I worked on this issue and we, you know, fought for the ban through protest and legislation. So I've been kind of working on this issue for a long time. So when I saw the news, I certainly jumped for joy because it's been a long time coming and way too long. Coming and you know, it's these little victories we have to celebrate. So
right. Well, and let me just add too, like the what foie gras is actually a pathological killing issue with birds. the only way that a liver is going to get to the condition that people want it to be in for foie gras is a condition that will kill a bird. And I know that because I've had to deal with numerous chickens who have developed fatty liver syndrome through their breeding and have died from it. So these are beloved companions who have died from the very situation that these farmers are cultivating through their feeding practices. That's deadly for a bird. Like there's no way around that. No matter whether those birds are running for it or running away from it, that condition, it will kill a bird. And there's no way that you can defend that as ethical, because that's the reality of the situation on the biological level.
Well, something that is done with industrial animal agriculture also is giving the animal two choices, and both choices are not happy choices. So one example is, I guess, running and getting fed with a tube or just starving.
Right.
Or who knows what else they might do. And then I know that with cows, they do something similar in some places too, where the cows don't really want to be milked. And then they're kind of given electrical prods or one way or another to get them moving from one place to another to keep it efficient and keep them moving. So it's a lesser of two evils. Okay, I'll move this way because I don't want to get hurt.
Well, and it's not even, and see, this is why the humane hoax to me is so so deeply disturbing, because not always it's a matter of outright cruelty. So I was actually on site on a very old and well-known goat dairy farm here in our area, and I watched the goats file in and line up at the mechanical milking machines in order to be milked. And this was very clearly a routine that they had down packed. And I see our roosters do this as well. Once it gets bedtime, they know what the routine is and they do it. And that's go to bed so that they're safe for the night. But at this farm, what I witnessed was the goats filing in, going into their slots, being hooked up to the milking machine, and they were getting fed. So what the farmer is doing in this situation is that they're relying on these animals' instinct
hunger
as domesticated animals to rely upon them for food and for, you know, the establishing what the routine is. And so, like, and I watched as these goats were bleeding from their udders as they were they were pooping on the milking machines. And, you know, I watched the entire process. And, like, what it drove home to me was is that these animals are bred to trust us as humans to tell them what the system is. And so they really have very little often control over the way that they instinctually respond to this. So, but when you associate feeding with coming into this place and being milked, you know, that's taking advantage of this process of domestication and making these animals docile. And I've seen that happen, and that's exactly what the system is. It's manipulating their breeding as domesticated animals to rely upon us and to rely upon a routine, and then, you know, that's when humans are able to take advantage of them.
And this is really the only way that the product that comes from these animals can be made profitable. Treating them in this awful way. I know people want to believe in these places with pretty little goats and organic dairies that the animals are being treated very well. But when there's a profit motive, you really can't trust the process.
That's absolutely right. That's what I found in my research for the book, that, you know, there's inherent cruelties that just, even no matter how humane a farm even wants to be, that they can't get around these certain very cruel agricultural standard procedures to be able to make a profit on that product. They have to take the calves away from the mothers in what is a psychologically traumatizing event for both mother and calf to be able to sell the dairy to the public. They have to do that. They have to buy the chicks from hatcheries. They can't profitably hatch their own chicks, so they have to source from these horrible industrial hatcheries like we talked about. They have to send the whole shed of 1,000 chickens to slaughter at just 2 years old because they have younger birds that are giving more eggs. I mean, there's inherent cruelties that just can't be wished away with a feel-good label. And you know, I think the industry, they realize this, and, you know, they know. And it was interesting to me, too. I saw there were farms here in Sonoma County that would have several sheds of egg-laying hens, and they'd have one shed that all the chickens were in battery cages. You know, just a standard, horrible battery cages where they were shoved in, you know, stacked on top of each other. And then right next to that, there would be cage-free, you know, like they're all just all free in the free from cages, but crammed into, you know, 1,000 birds in a windowless warehouse-like building that's still miserable. And then a third where they had a little bit of access to the outside. Now, what's going on here is that they don't care about the conditions of the animals. If they did, they'd have them all in what they considered the best conditions, right? They'd have them all, giving them a little access to the outside.
Yeah.
But they just want to make money. They wanted a new market and a new product and a new label to be able to make more money. So, you know, they don't care about these animals. It's all a business. It's about making money.
It's all
and
a
it's
business.
About a new
We have
market.
About a minute left. So why don't you tell us again how people can get involved with the Humane Hoax Online Summit, because I don't want anybody to miss it.
Yeah,
so
okay.
The best way to do it would be to go to our Facebook page, and that's very easily, you can easily reach that by searching for The Humane Hoax on, you know, Google or on Facebook. And the first post on our Facebook page and the event link that we have up, it will take you to the registration for the Humane Hoax, which will online summit, which will be happening this weekend, January 12th and 13th, starting at 1 p.m. Eastern Time both days. We'll have four different speakers each day, so please make sure to register for each day separately so that you're able to sign in. And we're going to have a very exciting event with wonderful speakers on each of those 2 days.
Excellent. I just want to add that I know, Hope, you mentioned it, and I mentioned it, but I'm going to mention it again. Your book, The Ultimate Betrayal, is an excellent piece, and I know you wrote it a few years ago, but it's all still, unfortunately, very current, and definitely a must-read. So thanks for writing that.
Agreed.
Yes, and we're actually going to be having a new one come out, the Humane Hoax Anthology, with a lot of the speakers that are speaking this weekend contributing chapters to that book. So look for that.
Okay, we will. Maybe we'll talk about that another time. Hope and Justin, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food and for everything that you're doing.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, we've come to the end of the program. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to another hour of It's All About Food. You can send me comments and questions to info@realmeals.org, info@realmeals.org. Visit me at responsibilityandliving.com, and have a delicious week.